Right. So I struggled a bit with the title because in the title I used it says A Road to Realism, but it's really a particular road that's been pioneered by my supervisor. But I thought this was a slightly more lame title, so I didn't go with it. The nice thing is that this covers kind of a broad slice of modern quantum foundations. So I'm going to hit on a lot of topics and kind of show how they're connected. It's kind of high level, it's not too formal. So if you're my colleague and you're in the audience, then you're not allowed to ask questions because there'll be some, like, I'll gloss over some points, but hopefully you'll get the picture for what modern quantum foundations, a lot of it, is all about. A lot of people have the picture that foundations is all about interpretations of quantum theory. And that's an important part of what we do, but it's like 5% of what we do. There's a lot more than that. So, okay, let me first describe for you two possible approaches to physics. There's the operationalist approach and the realist approach. The operationalist approach is really simple, and it aims to describe the world. That's the whole goal. So, for example, an operationalist would say, I've built some particular kind of laser. I shine it through some specific filter, wire up some electronics, and I observe some statistics. And the nice thing about talking about physics in this way is that there's very little assumptions there. We all agree about how to build laboratory devices. We all agree about how to report on statistics. There's no baggage about philosophy or interpretation here. And the question is this a good way of doing physics? Is that all that physics is about, is describing laboratory experiments? And I'm going to argue that really, as physicists, we usually want a little more. We do want to try and have some explanation of what's happening. So consider this equation, F equals ma. We all know what this stands for. And to an operationalist, this is a constraint on data. It says, if I have these three random variables and I do some experiments, I'll observe that they always satisfy this constraint. It's a kind of symmetric constraint. It's just the values will always be in accord with this equation. But intuitively, we know that this equation has a bit more content than just this kind of symmetric constraint on a data table. In particular, we think of this as a force causing an acceleration in a way that depends, of course, on the mass. So this is a kind of intuitive picture with arrows. So now it no longer looks like the symmetric thing. There's a kind of directionality. And it tells you, for example, if I go to this particle and I want to change its acceleration, I can change the force or the mass of the particle. But if I change the acceleration, that's not suddenly going to change the mass of the particle, for example. So this equation doesn't give you all that information, but we all have an intuitive story behind what's happening that tells us strictly more information. So let me give you a more interesting example. And this is going to be meant to highlight why we want more than just an operational point of view. So imagine that we've got a drug and we give people different amounts of treatment of the drug, and then we plot how well they recover. And we also take a note of their blood pressure. So here we see all the data. And if these are the only three variables that are relevant in this problem, then to an operationalist, this is a complete set of data. This is the whole story. We've described everything about the experiment we've done and what we've observed. And the question is, does this drug help people or not? Should I, as a doctor in real life, actually give someone the drug? Well, you might say, look, on average, the drug is positively correlated with recovery. So it looks like it's helping everyone on average. But if I look at just people who had blood pressure 50, among that subset of people, it seems to be hurting on average. Similarly, for this subset and this subset, for every subset of data, it seems like it's hurting people. But if you average all the people it's hurting, then suddenly it looks like it's helping. So it's clear that the statistics here are not enough to tell you whether the drug helps or not. And this is such a common thing in statistics that we all know this phrase, correlation doesn't imply causation. The data simply isn't enough to tell you whether the drug helps or not. Conditioning on blood pressure or not changes your opinion of what the drug does completely. So we're interested in knowing the net causal effect of treatment on recovery. It might be a direct effect, or maybe there's some indirect pathways through some auxiliary mediating variables, but we want to know the sum of all these pathways. And you can't find what the causal effect of the drug is just by looking at the data. We need some kind of story for where did the data come from. We need some assumptions about the causal relations between the variables. So let me give you two examples. If you happen to know, for whatever reason, that this is the correct causal structure describing treatment, blood pressure, and recovery. So, for example, this could explain the data by saying the drug has a positive effect on recovery by increasing your blood pressure, which then helps you recover. So this is a big positive influence that helps you recover. That's what accounts for this positive correlation. But there's also a side effect of the drug, which is negative. Maybe it's some small toxic effect of the drug, which is smaller than this effect. So if you average them together, you get a net positive. But now if you condition on the blood pressure, you'll be screening off this pathway. If you look at people who had a specific blood pressure, now you're not noticing the effect. You're blocking off this pathway and you only see the negative effect. So it looks like it's hurting everyone, but really it's not. It's helping everyone through this blood pressure effect. So if you know this is the causal structure, then you can just derive the fact that you should use all the average data and the drug actually helps people. So if you knew this was the causal structure, then you can use the data to decide what to do. In this case, give people the drug, it helps them. But if the causal structure was something else, namely, now the blood pressure is a common cause of treatment and recovery, it's not a mediary variable. In this case, we want to know, again, the net causal effect of the drug on recovery. Here, that's just this green arrow, which again is the negative arrow. And we don't care about any sort of common causes of the two. That doesn't represent any effect of the treatment on recovery. It's just a common cause. So an example of this might be maybe the doctor only gives you the drug if he sees you have high blood pressure. But the high blood pressure was going to help you recover anyway, whether or not you got the drug. So in this case, if you know this is the right causal structure, you should condition on the blood pressure because that screens off this correlation. It removes it. And then you see the truth, which is that there's a negative effect of the drug on each person. So the way that you use the data depends completely on what you know about what's actually happening. Now, of course, the hard question is, how do you know which of these is the true causal structure? That's a big topic that many people study. In some cases, it might be easy. Did you measure their blood pressure before or after you decided to give them treatment? That'll tell you that one of these two is very unlikely. So the moral of the story here is just looking at statistics isn't enough. Similarly, operationalism, it's a nice way of doing physics because there's very minimal assumptions, but sometimes you need to go more. You need to go further and try to give an explanation for what's happening. So that's the realist approach to physics. So formally, realism is the attempt to connect the abstract elements of your theory, the mathematical objects, try and say what are the physical objects and the properties of those physical objects which they directly describe. So that's the challenge here. And I think we're all, and this of course helps you explain, you know, what is the meaning of this formalism? Why do we care about it? What's the story behind it? Now we all know some simple examples of realism. We're kind of born realists, right? When we see F equals ma, we all know roughly what a force and a mass is and an acceleration. Similarly, I showed you this causal model. I didn't define it for you. And yet you all roughly know what this abstract symbol means. It's just an arrow, but you all know roughly what it means. But when I write psi of x, then it's a little more tricky and you might hesitate. What does this mathematical object represent in the world? But you could take the naive point of view and you could say, okay, here's an orbital of some electron in a hydrogen atom. And this is meant to describe a single particle, a single electron, so maybe it's really just this fuzzy blob in space. That would be the naive picture of what this wave function represents in reality. And that maybe that's a bit weird already, but maybe it's okay. Maybe somehow the single particle is just smeared out and you should just accept that. But this runs into problems if you take it to its extreme limit. So if you go to the macroscopic case, this is a perfectly well-defined mathematical object in quantum theory. But if I naively try to ascribe this some state of reality, it's like alive and simultaneously dead or something, then we all know that this is, it doesn't really make any sense to us as macroscopic classical beings who don't observe this kind of thing in the world. And another example, which I'll focus on now, is if you take this naive point of view, then in fact, the well-known wave function collapse when you do a measurement implies that there's some superluminal signaling. This is a very simple argument that you've probably heard before. So you start with some entangled state. If you ignore one system, system A, then the state of system B is just the completely mixed state in this case. You get that just by tracing out system A on this initial entangled state. So this, if these are two spins which are in an entangled state, this is like saying it's not spin up, it's not spin down, it's some completely random spin, or it has no spin in some sense. But now if party A does a measurement in the 0-1 basis and gets outcome 0, then instantaneously you update the other state to be in pure state 0. If you get outcome one, you update to pure state one. So if you really think that this is a description of the true state of what's going on at system B, then you've changed it from not being spin up or down to being either spin up or spin down, depending on the outcome of your measurement. You've really changed the true situation over here at B instantaneously, no matter how far apart these things are. So that's a causal influence. It's instantaneous. And obviously, there's some tension here with relativity. So this seems like a problem with the naive point of view that the quantum state is just describing what's really there at the deepest level. So let's be a bit more radical. Let's say, what if the wave function doesn't describe directly the spin of the particle? Does that mean we have to give up on realism and go be operationalists? No, I've already argued I don't want to do that. So let's do something in between. Let's try to stay realist, but do something a bit more sophisticated. So first of all, notice that the experiment I described for you has a really obvious classical explanation, right? All that I said was, I've done a measurement, and I've noticed perfect correlations between two systems that are far apart. Classically, I can prepare two coins that are always both heads up or always both heads down. And in such a case, this wouldn't describe the true state of the coin. It really is just heads up or down. This just says, I don't know what it is, so my state of knowledge is completely uncertain. And then when I learn what the first coin is, I update my state of knowledge about the second coin because I know that they're perfectly correlated. So that's a pretty obvious explanation of what's going on here. But I can make it a bit more tricky by introducing some second basis. So now I can measure in the plus or minus basis instead of the 0-1 basis. If I get outcome plus, I collapse to state plus. Outcome minus, I collapse to state minus. And it's often said that there's no classical explanation for this kind of correlations in different bases. That's a signature of entanglement, is this correlation in different bases. And I'm going to argue maybe there is a classical explanation for entanglement in different bases and correlations in different bases. So the reason that it's often said there is no classical explanation is because in sort of Newtonian mechanics, there aren't even any different bases. There's only one basis, the basis of knowing you can measure everything simultaneously. It's not like you have to choose position or momentum basis and measure one. But I'm going to show you an effectively classical theory which does actually reproduce all the quantum phenomena that I've introduced so far. So now I'm going to sketch for you kind of a simple toy model, which was invented by my supervisor, which I hope you'll agree with me is pretty much classical, and yet it reproduces entanglement, remote steering, wave function collapse, all that stuff. So the toy model goes like this. A single particle is described by a position and a momentum. And for simplicity, let's just take the case where position can be 0 or 1, momentum can be 0 or 1. So this is like a classical phase space. And the point, the true state of the particle is represented just by a point in phase space. So for example, if the particle has position 0 and momentum 1, then this is the true state. It's just this point in phase space. So I'll call this the ontic state. It's like ontic means about reality. So this is like the deepest description of reality, just a particle moving around like it would classically. And now here's the small departure from being strictly classical. I'm going to say, imagine that there's no way to prepare or measure this perfect delta function distribution on the phase space. I can't know exactly what the position and momentum are. So basically, I'm imposing as an axiom some kind of Heisenberg uncertainty principle, if you like. So in other words, what I'm saying is you can know the position of the particle. So here's a state where you know that position is 0, but you don't know anything about the momentum. So momentum is equally likely to be 0 or 1. Here you know the position is 1, but you don't know the momentum. Or maybe you know the momentum, but not the position. That would be one of these two states. And these two states, you don't know either position or momentum. So the position is given by the marginal on the left, as you see here. And the marginal is uniform. It's equally likely to be in the top two or the bottom two. So you don't know the position here or the momentum here, but you know that they're perfectly correlated. Either here you know they're perfectly correlated, where position and momentum are both 0 or both 1. Here you know that it's 0, 1 or 1, 0. So anti-correlation, correlation. So let's just assume as an axiom that these are the only possible states of knowledge you can have. There's a restriction on how much you can know about the deeper level of reality. And of course, you might know nothing at all, which is represented by this uniform probability distribution over the phase space. So from this one single small departure from classical reality, remember that we're still assuming there is an underlying classical reality, you just don't have access to it. From just that one assumption, we can derive a huge amount of quantum theory. So for example, we can derive that when you do a position measurement, you have to disturb the momentum. So imagine I started in this state where I know the momentum, and then I do a position measurement, which just tells me that I'm either in the top two or the bottom two. Well, then I'll know position and momentum, because I started knowing momentum, then I measured position. And that would be inconsistent with the assumption that you can never know both. So the only way to have a consistent theory then is you derive the fact that there must be a disturbance on the complementary variable. So when you measure position, you get a disturbance on momentum. And so what do I mean by disturbance? Well, let me explain for you how transformations work in this theory, because a disturbance is a kind of transformation. So at the deepest level, what's really happening is your point in phase space is moving around. That's simple. It's a classical particle on a classical trajectory. So here, for example, is the permutation corresponding to a translation in position. Here is the permutation corresponding to some interaction between position and momentum. But you never get to see these permutations directly, because you can't prepare or measure these point particles and then just watch how they move around. At best, what you can see are these epistemic states. So how do these permutations change your state of knowledge? Well, take this example. If the permutation is the one that swaps these two true states and leaves these other two invariant, then of course these two states are going to be invariant, because all that's going to happen is these two states will get swapped, these two states will get swapped. So this will get mapped to itself, this gets mapped to itself. Similarly, the state of knowing nothing gets mapped to itself. But if you started with this state, then you swap these two guys and you'll go back and forth between these states and these states. So that's a sort of one particular transformation in this theory. And note again that there's sort of these two representations. There's what's really happening over here, but all that you're ever allowed to know is described by these things over here. Okay, so I wanted to get to entanglement and different bases, so I need to have more than one system around. So far, it's all been one system. So let's take that phase space, just to represent this conveniently, and let's unwrap it and just represent it in a line. It's the same thing, just relabeled. And now it's easier to show what two systems look like. So we put system one on the left, system two on the right. And now we can look at their joint state as just a probability distribution over this larger phase space. And for example, here's a particular state where we know the momentum of both particles is equal to one, and we don't know anything about the position. So that has this probability distribution if you just go look at the labeling. A more interesting state would be this state. In this case, you don't know anything about the position or the momentum of either particle on its own. So to see the marginal state of system one, it's just the projection of these guys onto here. So it would be uniform. And similarly, the marginal state of system two is uniform over all four possible states. So you don't know anything about position or momentum. But what you do know is that they're perfectly correlated. Either the positions of particle one and two are both zero, or they're both one. And you know that the momentum of the two particles are both zero or both one. So this is, I'm going to argue, it's like an entangled state. You don't know anything about the local states, which are completely uncertain, but you have complete correlations between the two states. And I can make this more formal to give you a picture of how it works. Note that it reproduces the phenomenology that we discussed earlier. So I take this state, and now I consider, what if one party does a measurement of his position? So here, a measurement of position corresponds to, is it in the top half or the bottom half of the square? Now assume that it's in one of these two, the true state is one of these two guys. Well, then I'm going to get outcome zero. And then there's a momentum disturbance, and the state that I'm left with is this state. And so initially, the marginal on the distant system, system two, you knew nothing about it. But by doing a measurement on system one, you update your state of knowledge about system two. No matter how far away it is, you learn that it has to be in one of these two states. And if you just go look back at the labeling I introduced earlier, this is exactly the state of system two for which x equals zero. So measuring x equals zero on system one teaches you that system two also has x equals zero and unknown momentum. If I got the other outcome, outcome one instead of zero, then I update to this state. So I get the orthogonal state, and I learn that the distant system was also one. So perfect correlations in this basis. I can alternatively choose to measure momentum instead of position. I can't measure both because they're non-commuting, just like in quantum theory. But I can choose to measure momentum instead, which is like asking, is it in the first and third, or is it in the second and fourth rows? And then you just work through it, and you find the updated state looks like this. which says if momentum of particle one was found to be zero, then the momentum of particle two is also zero. If you found outcome one, this is the new state, the marginal in system two is also momentum equal to one. So all that's just to say, this behaves just like entanglement, at least phenomenologically. You see correlations in the different bases, and you steer the state to one of these four guys from the initial state of this guy. You're not actually perturbing the state of the system far away, you're just updating what you know about it. And this might sound a bit high-level, hand-wavy and vague, but at least for odd prime dimensions, there's actually an exact isomorphism. This is a true description of, can be used as a complete description of quantum theory. It gives you the predictions, not of the full theory, but of a sub-theory of quantum theory. So, for example, if I take these six states that I described earlier, I might associate, just call this quantum state zero on the Bloch sphere. Quantum state one, these are orthogonal, plus minus, plus I minus I, and the maximally mixed state. So note that I haven't reproduced all the states of the Bloch sphere, which is a continuum, but I can reproduce these seven states. And these are kind of, in some sense, really important states if you're interested in cryptography or communication or much of quantum information theory is all about these so-called stabilizer states. This is one of the sub-theory that's exactly reproduced by this toy theory is called the stabilizer sub-theory, and it's an extremely useful tool for quantum information processing because it contains these maximally entangled states. It contains, as I've argued, it contains entanglement, wave function collapse, remote steering. It's got a whole bunch of other stuff like superposition and no cloning theorem, teleportation, dense coding, all these things that you might think of, a bunch of technical stuff as well. If you think of all these as sort of intrinsically quantum phenomena, then you need to revise that thought, because what I've shown you is that all these phenomena in their most basic form can be described by a simple classical theory where you've got positions and momenta. And the only new thing here is that you impose some kind of restriction that you can't ever know the deepest level of reality. The quantum state describes like a probability distribution over the reality. It doesn't directly tell you what the positions and momenta are. So none of these phenomena are by themselves sort of hard to explain. We know how to explain the basic phenomena here in a simple way. And I think that's pretty interesting on its own. It's worth knowing, you know, how can I understand entanglement as something classical? Well, within this context, you can do it roughly in the manner that I've described here. So the key idea, how did we accomplish this? Because I'd say it's a pretty amazing feat. The key idea is to realize that the wave function is not describing the deepest level of reality. It's more like a probability distribution that tells us what we know about the underlying theory. And note that the underlying theory is still realist. So we're still being realists. We're still ascribing positions and momenta and kind of nice intuitive physical concepts to the mathematical objects in our theory. We're just doing it in a slightly more sophisticated way. Now, of course, this isn't the end of the story, because if it were, then we'd all adopt this kind of approach to quantum theory and we'd all understand it better. But no, this approach runs into problems. So what's the problem? The problem is it works exactly for a sub-theory. It doesn't work for the entire theory. And furthermore, even if you're really imaginative, you're not going to be able to modify the theory slightly to make it explain all of quantum theory. And the reason we know you can't do that is because we have Bell's theorem and some contextuality theorems, which say, if you assume some simple properties like local causality, which surely we all like that property, it's a good property that's motivated by relativity, then you won't be able to build such a toy model. So for example, the way Bell's theorem runs, just to give you the vague picture, just like before, we've got an entangled state and a measurement on one side. But instead of looking at the quantum state of the distant system, we just do measurements on the distant system as well. And we look at the correlations between these outcomes for different measurement bases. And what Bell's theorem says is that in such a case, you find correlations that are too strong to be explained by any such toy model that I gave, which is locally causal. So in other words, the wave function is not just a description of some knowledge about local hidden variables. That's what Bell's theorem says. So what is the wave function knowledge about if it's not local hidden variables? Well, we don't know the answer yet, but that's kind of the central focus of our research, at least here at PI. And now I'm going to go back to the start and kind of give you a clue how we might answer this question based on the causal models that I showed you earlier. So The causal models I showed you at the start were all classical, but even these classical causal models have only been understood for 2 or 3 decades. So even that field is pretty new. But now in the last 5 years or so, there's been an attempt to come up with a quantum generalization of classical causal models. And I think Nitika talked about this at least a little bit. This is a very vague slide, but roughly speaking, a classical causal model is something like this. C depends functionally on its parents, B and A. So there's a function like this. B depends functionally on A. And A doesn't have any parents, so it doesn't depend functionally on anything. It's just described by a probability distribution, which is kind of like our prior knowledge of what do we know about A. And the quantum generalization of this, super vaguely speaking, well, the functions are, of course, going to be unitary. C will unitarily depend on B and A. A will evolve unitarily into B. And instead of a probability distribution on A, we have a quantum state on A. And I argued, so a probability distribution, it's epistemic. It's about what we know. These functional dependences, they're really like mechanisms that exist out in the world. You know, they're like cogs and wheels and stuff that bounce off each other. So these have the feeling more of something ontic that really describe what's happening out in the world. And that fits well with what I said earlier, how the quantum state, it's like a state of knowledge. So you see this correspondence here. And so that suggests that unitaries, the description of dynamics in quantum theory, should have some relevance to this fundamental question of what is the wave function knowledge about? A good place to start would be looking at unitaries and trying to understand dynamics in quantum theory. So how do we usually describe dynamics in quantum theory? Well, we use circuit diagrams. So for example, here's a unitary. And this certainly tells us something about causal structure, right? It tells us that the A's can cause the B's, but not vice versa, because the A's come earlier than the B's. But it doesn't tell us everything. This is a kind of poor representation of causal structure. For example, imagine that we know A2 is a complete common cause of B1 and B3. If I just look at this figure, that's not at all obvious. From this figure, how do you know that A3 doesn't have a causal effect on all three of these guys? You don't really know it just from this picture. So what we'd really want is a deeper representation that goes beyond the circuit model. And so my supervisor and some collaborators have been working on this, and more recently myself. So we've come up with some kind of deeper graphical formalism. So instead of representing this unitary in this way, if this fact is true, then you can decompose it further. So this is like a way of taking your Hilbert space A2, and you decompose it into some subspaces, and then blah, 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 you can make all these things formal. But the key point is that now you have a graphical representation which explicitly shows you that A2 can affect B1, it can affect B2, and it can affect B3. But it also explicitly shows you A1 has no path to B3. It can only affect B1 or B2, and similarly for A3. So all that just to say that we're hopeful that if we keep working on these kinds of quantum causal models, and we come up with some deeper description than the usual ones, like the circuit picture, then we can get a kind of most informative description of how unitaries behave. And then from there, maybe we can back out. You know, this right now is just some abstract mathematical element, which I haven't even defined for you. If I did define it for you, it wouldn't be obvious how does that relate to physical objects in the world or their properties. But that's the end game. We want to find the deepest description mathematically. So we're rewriting quantum theory at the formal level. And then once we've accomplished that, only then can we hope to figure out what the sort of underlying realist picture is behind quantum theory. So that's pretty much it. I'll summarize now. So hopefully I've given you a flavor of a bunch of the kinds of questions that we're asking here at Perimeter. First of all, what is uniquely special about quantum theory? What makes it non-classical? If you thought it was just entanglement or teleportation, then I've argued that that's not a sophisticated enough point of view. Furthermore, once you know what's really special about quantum theory, that should be useful, right, to do useful things. If you've isolated the special part of quantum theory that goes beyond classical, then you should be able to do new kinds of information processing tasks that you couldn't do classically. So this suggests a kind of way of finding quantum advantages for real quantum information tasks. We're also trying to figure out how you should describe causal structure in quantum theory, which of course has relevance to quantum gravity and all kinds of other good things. I've argued that the quantum state is just a description of information, but we don't really know what it's information about. And the hope is that by understanding causal structure, we'll figure out eventually what the quantum state is information about. So if you find any of this interesting, you should definitely talk to me or send me an email. Also, you could talk to any of my colleagues here. Tomash and TC are also Rob's grad students. Tomash is giving the next talk. And that's all I wanted to say. So thanks.
You're not giving up on unitarity.
Right. I'm not giving up on unitarity.
But then, like, for that to work, you need to have, well, in quantum gravity, usually you don't get a unitary transformations, like, to evolve especially in time. So that wouldn't be compatible.
Right. I'm not an expert on quantum gravity, but I see that there's usually sort of two points of view. One is kind of the belief that you won't be able to sort out quantum foundations until you've sorted out quantum gravity, which maybe would fit with what you're saying, that if, for example, quantum gravity teaches us unitarity fails, then these points of view on quantum foundations might not work well because we're assuming a unitarity. But the other point of view is the opposite, that we won't make sense of quantum gravity until we've figured out quantum foundations. If we can't understand quantum theory on its own, how can we hope to ask the bigger questions if we're doing... So I might argue that it's very mistaken of current quantum gravity approaches to give up on unitarity. So it kind of depends on which problem you think needs to be solved first. And it's not really obvious which one is the better, which one does need to be solved.
But you're keeping unitarity because you're giving... like a lot of weight to all of these, we have to conserve probabilities.
Sure.
Probabilities have to be preserved.
That's a good motivation, yeah. I mean, the other motivation would just be that there's no experimental evidence to suggest the contrary. The arguments from quantum gravity are sort of high-level conceptual argument. And you could make similar conceptual arguments to keep unitarity, like the one you mentioned. So yeah, it's kind of unclear which approach will teach you more about the other, quantum gravity about foundations or foundations about quantum gravity. But I'm no expert on that.
That's fine, David.
All right, thanks.